In 1987, Garrison Keillor stopped delivering his weekly reports from the fictional town of Lake Wobegon. It was a year of big changes for Keillor. He left his public radio program, A Prairie Home Companion, which he hosted for 13 years. He married Ulla Skarvet, a Danish woman who he hadn't seen since she was an exchange student in his high school. After their marriage, they spent the summer in Copenhagen, then moved to New York. It was the first year Keillor ever lived outside of Minnesota. The self-described shy person has had to learn how to be famous. He spent a week on the cover of Time magazine, surely the only public radio host with that distinction, and he's had three bestsellers. His latest, Leaving Home, just out in paperback, is a collection of Lake Wobegon stories. His forthcoming collection, We Are Still Married, will be published in April. We invited Garrison Keillor to the NPR Bureau in New York to read from his forthcoming book and to tell us what his life has been like since leaving A Prairie Home Companion. I wanted to know, as one radio person to another, what it was like to actually leave the show after so long.
It's a jolt. It's like walking off a small cliff. It's hard on your lower back. it's a great surprise.
Do you miss the adrenaline and do you miss the deadlines?
I was kind of running out of adrenaline. That was my problem. And I wasn't getting nervous enough. So I took a layoff, and now I do the occasional show in a theater and walk out on a stage, and I'm pleased to report that I can get scared with the best of them. I get so scared I forget the second verse of Hello, Love, which I always used to think was sort of engraven somewhere in the base of my brain.
Did you ever have a terrible moment of second thoughts after you left doing the show regularly and say to yourself, oh my God, what have I done?
Oh, I had 100 of them. I had 100 of them. I went over to Denmark pretty smartly right after the end of that thing. We just bought an apartment in a section of Copenhagen, and there wasn't a stick of furniture in it. And I was going to language class, and so I went from all of these encomiums and farewells and all of this affection of the audience over to sitting in a bare room in Copenhagen and then going down to a bare classroom and talking about knives and forks and, you know.
Oh, where, is it language study?
Where is my suitcase?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the bathroom? So it was a long fall there, but it's exciting. You know, it's good for you. It sure gets your attention, and I recommend it.
Recommend what? A big change?
I do. I really do. I think that somewhere in there, around the middle of your 40s or somewhere, a person needs to go up in a plane and jump out of it or do something dramatic.
Well, you know, when you're doing something on a regular basis like you had been doing with Prairie Home Companion, I think it's easy to convince yourself about all the great things you'd be doing if you gave it up, if you changed your life, on all the things you'd be doing if you just had a little bit more time. In your case, I'm sure, writing figured into that agenda. Once you had the time, were you able to do all the things that you wanted to, or did they become more difficult than you expected?
They always were difficult. I didn't imagine that writing a novel would become easier because I had more time to sit and look at blank paper. But I still wanted to do it and am doing it and intend to finish it. And in the meantime, I've been fooling around doing some writing for The New Yorker and doing some shows and this, that, and the other thing. But I did want to write this book. I'm working on a novel. It's set in the early 50s and at a radio network, a small radio network in the Midwest. And all these people like you and me and our friends in radio, the bottom has dropped out of their world. Television has come in over the horizon, and they're all just about to be out of work. And that's what I want to write about.
Now, this will be your first published novel. I think I remember a story of you writing a novel that you kept in a big box under your bed and you eventually threw it out?
I did. I put that into a landfill somewhere in Minnesota. I doubt people are raising much corn where I planted that thing. It's pretty deadly. Should be a law against that, probably.
You've still been writing Lake Wobegon short stories.
Yes, I do. I still am curious about those people, and so I still write about them so that I can find out what's happened to them.
I guess I was surprised that you were still doing that. I kind of thought that when you gave up the show that you'd also give up the characters. But I guess, as you said, there was more to find out.
Well, there is a lot more to find out. I'm not publishing them any place. I haven't so far. Don't really have any plans to. But mm-hmm. I do sit down and write on them.
I was wondering if Lake Wobegon was a way out of writing autobiographically for you, a way of putting everything you knew into your writing without implicating the living.
I sure implicated a lot of the living, and it's only recently that my relatives will start to confide in me again now that I'm not on the radio on Saturday nights. Some of them will actually tell me a few details of their lives. They were afraid, and rightfully so, that they'd become material. When you do a weekly show and you intend to tell a 20-minute story as a part of it, you become hungry for material, and you use anything that happens around you without shame. So I miss doing those stories because they were a way of putting into making, they were a way of making sense of just about anything that happened to me. I could make it happen to somebody in Lake Wobegon, and they would somehow figure out things that I was unable to myself. So I miss that. I miss doing those stories. I'll sneak back into it someday. I'll get some early morning show on some little 250-watt AM station up in northern Michigan, you know?
My guest is Garrison Keillor, and by the way, his bestseller, Leaving Home, is out in paperback, and he has a new book coming out in a couple of months, another collection of short stories called We Are Still Married. Let me ask you to read something from the new collection, and before I ask you to read it, I should say that I think one of the reasons, well, I know one of the reasons why you left doing A Prairie Home Companion was because of all the attention that the press was paying you and the intrusiveness that you felt. It was causing.
Are you asking me?
Well, I guess it was a statement with a question mark at the end, wasn't it? But you mentioned at the beginning of Leaving Home that what happened was you had bought a new house, and while you were out of town, the house and its address was printed in the newspaper, and I think the price that you paid for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this seemed to you like a real invasion of privacy, and that you were paid much too much attention to. That had a lot to do with your leaving, right?
I left because it's just too strange to live in St. Paul, which I wanted to do and intended to do for the rest of my life. I was really too old to leave, I think. But you know, in order to make somebody into a celebrity, you have to put them at a distance, and that's just too painful to do in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's not that big a place. You know, you keep running into people at the grocery store and in church and restaurants and so on. I ran into the editor of the newspaper in a restaurant. We both liked the same restaurant, and you know, she was kind of embarrassed to run into me. She sort of apologized. And so it's just too odd, you know. It's a strangeness that leaks into your life. It's like a bad taste in the drinking water, and you move away, go someplace where you can be anonymous. And the big city, people have been moving to the big city for hundreds of years for the very identical reason: to be anonymous,
mm-hmm.
just to be individuals. And it's a sweet thing.
I'm going to want to ask you about moving to the big city, but first I'd really like it if you did a reading from your forthcoming collection, We Are Still Married.
And I will now do a reading from my forthcoming collection. What would you like me to read from this forthcoming?
If you could read an excerpt of My Life in Prison, which has already been in print, and which magazine was it, Garrison?
That was in that Atlantic. Do they still call it the Atlantic Monthly? Or?
I'm never sure. I just call it the Atlantic myself. I think monthly might be vestigial at this point.
I see.
But I think this is a really funny piece, and the part you're going to read really comments about being the center of all the publicity.
I don't know. I'm not sure if this is funny or not. I never am clear on that. Tell me if I come to a funny part.
Okay.
Ever since the day I first walked out on stage and blinked and cleared my throat, people have written some terrible things about me that aren't true, but it doesn't matter. I've done a lot of terrible things in secret that nobody wrote about, so it all evens out. My sister used to say terrible, untrue things about me to my parents, but it didn't matter because they didn't believe in innocence anyway. When they caught us pounding on each other, they just grabbed the nearest one and sent him up to his room. And if I said she hit me first, the truth, it made no difference. I still got punished to make up for the times they probably had made a mistake in my favor. Their punishment backfired in my case. I loved to be sent up to my room. My books were there, my tablets, my plastic soldiers. It was good up there. If they wanted to punish me, they should have sent me out to play with other children. Solitary confinement was my idea of fun. It was a chance to sit down and talk to myself, and that's what naturally led me into radio, which led to so much more, including those terrible, untrue things. This is the sort of thing I mean, which happens often. A reporter calls up and says how much he's always liked my work. Could he take me to lunch? So he does, something expensive like walleye sushi, and he asks me 10 questions about life and love and laughter. And then he turns on his tiny tape recorder and asks, "What's the worst thing your folks ever did to you?" I tell him that sometimes they punished me for nothing. And he writes his story, Rich Writer, Bitter Toward Mom, 74. I understand. He's only doing his job. There's nothing personal about the piece. Journalism is a moral art. It draws pictures in bold strokes. The newspaper columnist back in St. Paul, who combed the town for children whom I had disappointed, is a deeply moral writer. The man who wrote, "Timmy lies in pain while Hero laps up New York glitz and glamour." A very sick little boy lies on a broken bed in a dank basement apartment on the south side, waiting for hours for the mailman. A few minutes after 1 o'clock, when he hears the rustle of mail in the fetid hallway, he climbs painfully from the soiled sheets and limps to the door and stops with his little hand on the cold knob and says an Our Father, but so far it hasn't been answered. Every day, Timmy whispers Garrison Keillor's name and looks for an envelope containing the autographed photo he requested from the former Prairie Home Companion host way back in March 1987. Doctors say that such a signed photo could give Timmy the spark of hope he needs in order to live. His aunt Brenda says if only Garrison knew how much it means to us, surely as a Christian he would spare 30 seconds to autograph a picture. But would he? Keillor, who sleeps all day and spends his nights cavorting with the glitterati and the niteries of Sodom, is said to be quite satisfied with his new famous friends and his new life of luxury and excess. I read that story and suddenly realize why PR people send out gallons of Johnny Walker at Christmas and serve prime rib sandwiches in hospitality suites and hotels. Journalists are hungry people. The PR guy, courtly, English, walks up to the sleaziest writer in the room and lays an arm across his dandruffy shoulders and murmurs, "You know who you remind me of? Edward R. Murrow. I mean it. You've got that same intensity, that kind of grace, like what Yeats wrote about." How does that line go? "Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds." Can I get you a scotch? The reporter, a man with watery eyes and 40 pounds of old cheeseburgers around his waist, blushes and stares down at his hush puppies, and for the next 20 years you will have no problem with him at all. He will go chase the university president, tax money lavished on executive suite while the dying lie in dim alcoves at U Hospital, or snipe at the archbishop, prelate fails to attend cripple's dinner for third year in row, or haul off and slug the mayor, politician denies persistent rumors of pet molesting. And he will not go writing these stories full of everybody who has a grudge against you. He'll write, "Everyone in this town knows Garrison Keillor is a wonderful entertainer and devoted father, but I wonder how many of us are aware of those dozens of little unsung deeds he does for the poor and unfortunate every week." A PR guy would sing some of those deeds in a nice low voice so that a columnist could hear them. I don't have a PR guy, but once I did hire someone named Milo to attend rehearsals and yell, "All right," every time I sang a song. I was sensitive about my voice and needed affirmation in order to do my best. He sat among the band, and in that awkward silence after a song when the musicians reached for a smoke, Milo yelled, "All right, far out, whoo, you sang that one all right." Milo is quoted in my biography as saying that I was selfish. That's a sad story. Hard life.
I should say that the story that you just read from is called My Life in Prison, and it will be included in your forthcoming collection, which is called We Are Still Married, and that's scheduled for publication in April on Viking Press. In the monologues that you've done over the years, you've really told us all a lot about yourself, although the names have been changed. But in the last few years, you've had to do so many interviews that you've really had to, I'm sure, draw some kind of line between what's public and what's personal in your life. And I've been wondering if that's a hard line to draw and where you've decided to draw it.
Well, my wife says that I don't draw it as tightly as I should. And she and I talk about it at great length. It's an interesting question. A writer does use things that happen to us, I don't know of any other way to write about these characters other than to carry over my own experiences into their lives. So it's a predicament. On the other hand, I have a family, and I have a mother and father, and brothers and sisters and cousins and aunts and uncles who I don't care to embarrass, which I certainly have in writing Lake Wobegon Days, for example, which I wrote a great deal in the first person, and I wrote about fictional aunts and uncles and a mother and father who I considered fictional in the book, but people oftentimes read that as a factual autobiography. So it's a problem that I don't have an answer for. But ever so often you run the risk, if you're a writer, maybe you'd write a story and use a first name for a character, and then months later, years later, run into an old friend who had that same first name, and the look on her face of pained poisoned politeness, and you know something's wrong, and you find that your fiction went awry, and you hurt somebody whom you loved.
I'm interested in where you draw the line between public and private for the press when you're doing interviews. And I'm interested in this both as someone who is an interviewer and as someone who has occasionally been interviewed. I mean, now, in your case especially, you made headlines for your marriage, you know, for marrying Ulla Skarved. And, I mean, that's a very personal thing, deciding to get married, especially, you know, when you're in your mid-40s, you know, when it's later on in life. And everybody wanted to know about it. Your listeners wanted to know why you were doing it. The press wanted to know. And you had to decide, well, what's for the public to know and what's just personal?
Mm-hmm. Well, when people ask me questions, I try and tell them the truth. And so it's what I've tried to do when I have gone out on stage. I don't wear a costume when I go out on stage, and I do talk about a town that that people know to be fictional, and yet when I tell them stories, and especially if I talk in the first person, they assume it to be the truth, and it is. I don't go out and play a character on stage. Mm-hmm. So I guess that if if a reporter asked me a personal question, I'd probably look at them and answer it, which may be a mistake. I don't know.
You told us before that you came to New York for the anonymity, and although you wouldn't have anonymity exactly in New York, there's lots of famous people in New York, so famous people are slightly less fussed over, I think, than they are in a lot of other places. New York's a big change for you, aside from the brief amount of time you spent in Denmark. The only place you ever really lived was Minnesota. And I'm thinking that New York is a much tougher place. Probably there's a lot more crime, and everybody in New York knows that they have to walk with this real assertive style so that you're not picked on or mugged. And I wonder if this has affected the way you walk down the street or anything?
It hasn't. I don't feel that way about it. I think since I moved to New York in the year and a half that I've lived here, I think that at least 20 people have walked up to me and said, "Excuse me, but your billfold is sticking up out of your back pocket," or words to that effect. And it's true. I mean, I walk around town like a Midwesterner. I stare up at the tops of buildings because the sidewalks aren't that interesting, and with my billfold sticking out of my back pocket. I'm not affected by it at all. I don't feel afraid in New York at all. I think that the fear that people feel about New York is a fear felt in our behalf by people who live elsewhere and who can imagine how dreadful and frightening it must be. But in fact, I feel much more frightened in smaller cities when I need to walk someplace and I suddenly find myself in this barren urban terrain of parking lots and vast open spaces and dimly lit side streets. That's when I start to get nervous. In New York, I'm surrounded by crowds of people. There may be a lot of panhandlers. There may be sad and crazy and unfortunate people, and you may find it depressing. But you don't feel. I don't feel it dangerous at all. Not really.
One quick Denmark question. When you were living in Denmark, and you couldn't really speak the language, I was thinking about what that was like and thought that perhaps the most difficult thing would be not being able to have a sense of humor, because that's the most complicated part of language, using irony or humor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get other people's jokes and they can't get yours?
Jeg forstod en lille smule dansk humor.
Breaks me up.
Ikke det alt. Det er meget ironiske mennesker. Yeah.
I think our listeners around the country are probably curious about what your touring schedule is like. Are you making a lot of stops nowadays with the touring show that you've been doing?
No, I've just been doing a few. I did a show with the Chicago Symphony over Valentine's Day. It was most fun. What a great symphony it is. And I did some songs with them and did a long piece called A Young Lutheran's Guide to the Orchestra. That is... it's a lot of fun to do. Did a story about Lake Wobegon. Then I lay off, and I'm going to be writing for a couple of months, and then I'm going to do a long tour for the third annual farewell, and take the Prairie Home Companion troupe across the country and play a lot of cities that we've never played in and always wish that we had.